All right, everybody. So we are going to start our next session that I'm very, very excited about because we have some amazing guests, and we're very honored that they took the time out of their busy schedule to come and speak to us today. I think you're going to enjoy it. Once they finish speaking, it's going to be interactive, and you're going to be able to ask questions, and so I hope that you do. Jot some down while they're speaking. If something comes to mind, write it down, and in just a little bit, you'll have a chance to ask some questions. So, but before we start, I get to give you another word for your bingo card. So for those of you dedicated attendees, so the next word is beaches. And with my southern accent, I hope that didn't sound like the other word. All right, so we're going to start this next session with a presentation on HS awareness. And this is a partnership between the SDPA, the AAPA, and Novartis Medical Affairs. And it's going to be presented by Jane Mast. So Jane, if you did not know, is a past president of the SDPA from 2017. She is a medical director now, you guys, which is huge, at Novartis. She practiced dermatology for 20 years. She still enjoys seeing patients. She has built her professional career around the needs of patients and addressing medical education needs in the field of dermatology. Next, after Jane presents, we're going to hear from Alicia Quella. She's the Director of PA Relations at the NCCPA. She has served as a PA educator and has practiced in emergency medicine and primary care. She has served as an epidemiologist during the COVID-19 pandemic, and has published research on the PA workforce, global health, and issues affecting diversity in PA program admissions. And then finally, we're going to hear from Jennifer Orozco. She is the president and chair of the American Academy of PAs. Much of Jennifer's career has been dedicated to both the clinical and academic leadership teams at Rush University System for Health in Chicago, Illinois. Currently, she's the director of advanced practice providers across the hospital system and continues to practice vascular surgery. In addition, Jennifer is a member of Rush University's faculty and an assistant professor in the Department of PA Studies. So we're going to start with Jane Mast. If you'll please welcome Jane to the stage.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. And one of my requirements for speaking today was that I did not follow the magician. I really felt for whoever had to go after that because that was an amazing keynote speech this morning. So today I want to talk to you about partnership. And I actually read a great book recently that was called Partnering. And the concept is that we can do so much when we partner together to really help things in the world, solve those problems, keep that curiosity. So one thing that the SDPA and the AAPA and Novartis Medical Affairs did this year is we did that. We partnered on a campaign around HS awareness. So I want to go back to a story that I have about a patient that I saw. She was a 30-year-old woman, came into my office, and this was the first time she was seeing a dermatology provider. She had been to numerous ERs where she had had abscesses drained. She had been to her OBGYN, who diagnosed her with an infection. She had been on numerous courses of antibiotics, including a round of IV vancomycin. When I, you know, saw her in the clinic, it was clearly that a diagnosis of HS, right? She had hidradenitis suppurativa. And she had gone through many years of pain and discomfort being misdiagnosed with having infections. So we wanted to do something about this, right? Why is HS important? Well, HS is often a hidden disease. We know that people are, on average, misdiagnosed for 7 to 10 years before they get a proper diagnosis. And it's not because they're showing up in your office, right? If they're showing up in your office, I have no doubt that you are all giving them a proper diagnosis. But they're going to the wrong healthcare providers. They're going to the urgent cares. They're going to the ERs. And so we said, what can we do about this? You know, the SDPA, the AAPA. And so one of our goals was, we don't want these patients to ever be misdiagnosed by an advanced practice provider, right? So we actually did this campaign where we did several social media posts, we did blogs that really talked about HS and talked about how do you diagnose HS, just recognizing the disease. And we aim this actually at the entire PA community. And so these are just some of the stats that we had, but we do feel like we made a great impact. We had a LinkedIn and Twitter campaign, along with other social media and outreach strategies for this disease state. So what is the role that we can play in this disease? We can definitely get passionate about treating these patients. I heard another story recently. Someone said there is only one HS expert in the entire state of Ohio, and he's retiring this year. There are deserts of HS care that exist in this country where patients are not being treated. Can we fill that gap? I think we can. So, you know, my challenge to you is to really upskill your treatment of these patients. I think this is a gigantic opportunity for us to take care of these patients and to provide them that care. Also, if you want to get involved in the HS awareness campaign, particularly for, you know, your local OBGYNs, your local ERs, you know, please come see me throughout the conference. I would love to get you partnered with us in ways that we can do that together. Also, if you're not aware of it, the HS Foundation is a great resource for you and your patients, and they're really passionate. There's a lot of research that's going on right now into HS, and they also have patient resources. So if you're not aware, they have a great website, and there's even training videos and conferences they offer throughout the year to really upskill treatment of HS. So I want to thank so much the SDPA and the APA for participating in this campaign. And I hope we continue to do this throughout the year. And I hope the next time I get to speak to you, I'm telling you that that gap is down to 2 years instead of 10. So thank you so much. I'm going to pass it over to Alisa.
Hi, everybody. Good morning. I'm Alisha Quella, and I am a full-time staff at the NCCPA. I've been a PA for over 20 years, and, you know, just like my introduction, and right now I'm working directly with NCCPA, and today we're going to go over two major updates from the NCCPA. One is, which I've already getting a lot of buzz at our exhibit, we have the focus on the PANRI alternative, and we're going to go over that in detail, and the second is the new CAQ, the DERM CAQ that's available, and we have a lot of information at our booth for those of you that are interested in the new DERM CAQ, which involves, a component of experience. It involves attestation of certain cases and procedures, and finally an exam, a really small exam actually. And so that's available now, and your CAQ is starting. But I just wanted to give you a heads up on that because we're really going to focus now on this recertification process. All right, so we're going to just jump right in. So what is the process for developing this new PANRI alternative been like? It's really been thoughtful and deliberate. We actually have been preparing it for over 5 years and really relying on feedback from PAs on how we were going to do this recertification process. We did a lot of environmental scanning. We looked at physician groups. We looked at other healthcare providers to see how they were doing their recertification process. And finally, we used extensive qualitative and quantitative feedback from the pilot. And I Does anybody want to let me know out there who did the pilot? It's helpful to know. Okay, full disclosure, I also did the pilot. I was a pilot taker before I even took this position, so I can actually speak from experience quite a bit on how this new process is going to run. All right, there's a paradigm shift, and I know we've got a lot of educators out there. We're really kind of shifting from assessment of learning, which is that one and done exam, to assessment for learning. And it's a process that's more formative and summative as you go along. And this is more the adult learning theory where, you work on a question, you read the answer afterward, and actually you're learning along the way, which has been very, very attractive to a lot of us PAs, especially those in specialties that have, aren't as seeing as much of the generalist knowledge. So really we're trying to shift away from that really, kind of cramming for the exam like we all did in PA school. I remember we used to have to do comprehensive finals in every class. I was also a PA educator, program director for years, so I know what it's like, and so really we wanted to shift that and make it a more enjoyable, less stressful experience. There's also been a shift in the tone between the NCCPA and certified PAs, really more open to feedback, more communicative with PAs, and kind of letting you know what we're up to well in advance. Okay, let's go over longitudinal assessments just a little bit, and we're not going to spend too much time on, but these are shorter assessments spread over a longer period of time, giving yourself time to read, look at the blueprint, etc. Again, this is a reoccurring process and is supported by research showing that we actually retain more knowledge, even generalist knowledge. We're actually be able to apply it in clinical situations. This is more realistic for us practicing PAs, where a lot of times if you don't know the answer, you're going to be able to look it up anyway, and we're going to talk about how the exam allows you to use a resource. Finally, this is not a new concept, but new to more us and some other physician groups, and this has in some sort been adopted by the 24 American Board of Medical Specialties, which kind of encompasses about 80 medical and surgical specialties across the nation. All of them are moving more to this recertification kind of longitudinal process. Finally, the nurse anesthetists are also considering this model. So we're not the only ones. We do hear it a lot that we're the only ones that have to go through the process, but we're really in line with our physician peers. All right, what are some takeaway for the pilot people out there? And I get a lot of questions about this. So each subgroup or each group of PAs, whether it's broken down by specialty, by age, whatever, they all improved over time on the pilot. It's almost like you got used to the format, you're kind of cruising along, and everybody improved. In fact, PAs in general scored 2 standard deviations above the passing mean, which is incredible. I mean, PAs, we tend to really, hit it out of the park, and we did it again on the pilot. Another takeaway is PAs really valued the immediate feedback they received after each question. So I don't know if you remember test taking out there, but you can always narrow it down to 2 things, and sometimes we talk ourselves out of the right answer. So you would choose an answer, then you get the immediate feedback afterwards, whether it was right, whether it was wrong, and that's the learning process that's in the exam. A lot of times, working with students for years, I would always say, why are you guys talking yourself out of the right answer? You cannot go back and change your answer later either, which is nice because you got to commit and move on. So PAs appreciated that. They really like the at-home format. Some people would say, I get my jammies on, go sit, quiet spot, and take, open one question up at a time and take the exam. That was very convenient, and PAs really liked that. Finally, the ability to use a resource. Now, this is where it gets a little bit confusing because on the pilot, you had 2 minutes up to 5 minutes to actually use a resource, and all that feedback the pilot takers gave us was, hey, we want the maximum amount of time, so you don't feel rushed. But can anybody guess what is the average amount of time people use to use a resource? Between 2 and 5 minutes, does anyone want to guess? Exactly, yeah, so about 2 to 3, the average time, and so 5 minutes will give you, the most time, and I think you'll find that it's more than enough to use a resource. All right, other comparisons. There's going to be 25 questions a quarter. The quarters are 10 weeks long. You open up one question at a time. So as I was an emergency medicine PA, so if I was called away, if I was taking the exam, you know, you open the question, you finish it, and then you don't need to open up the next question if you don't have time to do it. So what I noticed, though, from talking to PAs is once they started rolling on these questions, they usually did them all in one sitting. They were like, you kind of got on a groove, and you're like, oh, this isn't as bad, and they would finish it all. And that's actually what I did, is I would just open them up, and I was feeling confident, and we just finished the 25. There's going to be a same number of scored quarters, which is 8. The quarters are scored in aggregate. So you will get a notice on how you're doing as you're moving along, but to get the pass, not pass at the end is 8 quarters total. The items will be administered on device, again, one by one, laptop, desktop, iPad, anything like that, they all work. Again, you can log in and out whenever you want. You can use references, not people references, but use references at your convenience. I usually get the question, what are people recommending? Now I look at, you know, I pay attention to the huddle, kind of what people are talking about too. And some people really liked UpToDate. Some people used the, you know, their CMDT or their current textbook. I got a lot of different answers on this one. So what I really advise PAs is to use what feels more comfortable to you on your generalist knowledge if you were working and were looking something up. I wouldn't start with a new resource. The other item is, you know, you can try one resource. You're only opening up one question at a time. If it's not working for you, your reference, then you would have time to, you know, stop and switch a reference if you needed to. Finally, you can, you're going to get that immediate feedback on whether it was right or wrong, and, you know, your critique afterwards. You're going to get 2 survey questions after each question you answer, and the pilot people might remember this. It's how confident were you in this material? How relevant was this to your practice? If you were highly confident, this is a really relevant topic, but you got it wrong, that actually will be flagged for a later quarter, and you have a chance to answer it correctly. If you answer it correctly the second time, it will take away that negative score. So you actually are able to improve your score as you move along. And that's the remediation items that will begin after quarter one. Okay, what are some differences? You actually have up to 3 years to complete the 8 quarters, and there will be a 12 quarters total available. So remember, passing is at 8, but if you don't pass, you have 4 extra quarters to improve your score. And so it's up to 3 years. You can skip quarters. Now, I've actually been doing a lot of talking. We have some PAs that will be deployed during this time and worried about internet. I also was just in Alaska talking to some of the PAs there, and they had some, you know, they're stationed in areas that don't have the best internet, and there's some worry about that. So you can either skip a quarter, because again, you have up to 12, or you can, you know, schedule it a time when you have good internet. There's going to be the same time per item, 5 minutes, like we talked about. You can pocket or save for later some topics. So, you know, here you are, derm PAs, maybe you have a cardiovascular question coming, not really ready to answer cardiovasculars. You can save that topic for later. So it'll let you do that before you open up the question. They'll give you time to look at the blueprint or something like that so that you don't need to commit to that topic right away. Finally, the most popular part of this is you can actually earn CME along the way. The NCCPA will award you 50% more for self-assessment CME credit, and so for each quarter you can get up to 3 credit of self-assessment CME for your record, and that's Category 1, and that has been approved by the AAPA. So for over 8 credits, you could get up to 24 Category 1 CME for participating, and that's because you are learning along the way, you're using resources, etc. Okay, so here's the overview of your timeline. Just forget where you are for a minute. We're just going to go over this very quickly. You're going to sign up for the PANRI LA in year 6. You start your 3 years or your 12 quarters, years 7 through 9. And then year 10, once you've passed, you're done. Year 10, if you did not pass the exam, you have up to 3 attempts to take the traditional PANRI. You know, the go to the testing center, get patted down, take the PANRI. So you actually have 3 attempts on it if, you know, something happened, you did not pass. So this is really important to know. It's a safety net. Along the timeline, nobody would lose their certification either, so it would remain intact. So So why is this so important? We're doing a lot of talks about this right now. Your application is open now if you are in years 2024, 2025, and 2026. And I've already talked to a bunch of you kind of circulating around, but you have less than 2 weeks to sign up. We're starting all these 3 years together and the first cohort to do the Pannery LA. So you have about 2 more weeks to sign up. It's the same price as the Pannery. And also, I do have my one-and-done exam takers out there that are like, I always do the CME course, I go to Chicago, I do my 5-day course, I take the Pannery, and then I'm done with it. That will always still be an option for you because we do have people that don't want to spread this out over years. So rest assured that will be always an option. Here's just a timeline for these. On the vertical axis is 2024, 25, 26. It walks you through your timeline a little bit. Of note, because we're starting these three groups together, you all have the 3 years to take all 12 quarters. You all get the final year to do, you know, retake the Pannery if needed. There's going to be no change in the certification process. Okay, so everybody has the same opportunity. All right, before we leave the Pannery, I wanted to point out the blueprint. The blueprint was updated from PAs that came together and said, listen, this is more core medical knowledge. Again, I always remind, especially newer PAs, PAs coming right out of PA school, this is not the PANTS blueprint. This is a much more abbreviated, more narrow, more specific to the type of studying that you're going to be doing type of blueprint. And it was just updated again from PAs that came to the office and actually sat through and looked through the blueprint, making sure that this was relevant within a specialty, you know, across specialties. There is more specificity involved in the blueprint, which I'm going to actually go to an example next. But before I leave this slide, I wanted just to point out there's a link to practice questions. So if you want to look at what one of the Pannery practice questions look like, it's linked here for you. Now, I do get the question whether, is the Pannery LA harder than the Pannery? No. It's the same blueprint. It's the same type of questions. One is not harder than the other. Some of you out there might remember Pathway 2. That was the old take-home exam. That was really hard. This is not a Pathway 2 exam. Finally, there's a tutorial that I linked. If you wanted to go through the tutorial, see what it looked like before you committed, it's linked on the slide there. Here is an example of the cardiovascular. I purposely put that up there because when you start studying for the Pannery LA or the Pannery, you don't want to always start with things that you're familiar with. You know, our natural inclination is to go to, oh, I'm going to start with the derm and see what that. No, you go to things that you struggle with or, you know, is less familiar. So here's just a little snapshot of the cardiovascular system. It's also separated into 4 levels, history and physical up to intervention complex. Now, being an emergency medicine person and primary care, let's pick on MI here. MI, you need to know up to intervention complex. What does that mean? It means that you're reading, you're not reading to memorize anymore. You're just reading, you're reviewing the topic and moving on. You can check it off, move on. But again, this is not reading to memorize anymore. You're just refreshing your knowledge. Then other topics like abdominal aortic aneurysm, you know, we don't need to know at the complex. That's more specialty related. So this is more just the generalist knowledge. But anyway, this kind of guides your reading a little bit or your preparation. Also, remember, you get a heads up on the content area that's coming, so you could take a look at the blueprint before you start it. All right, so I just wanted to give one more plug to the Derm CAQ because we're here. We've got some information at our booth. And I also want to let you know that we're going to be here for the next couple days. So if you want to come and stop at our booth, you have individual questions about anything, recertification, your CME, we're here to walk you through it. And that's it. I know there's going to be questions time after, but I'm going to turn it over to the president and chair of the AAPA, Jennifer Orozco. Come on up.
Okay. Hi, guys. I love seeing so many PAs in one room. And I'm going to apologize in advance because I'm a walker. So I'm going to try not to walk and stay behind here. And I've given this talk a couple of times now, and I'm happy to do it again. And So for those that don't know me, I'm Jenna Roscoe. I've been a practicing PA in vascular surgery for about 20 years now, but mainly am in administration now. I went to the dark side of the evil trolls in administration, and am responsible as director of advanced practice in Chicago for about 400 nurse practitioners and PAs across the system. So outside of that, being involved with the AAPA has really been exciting, and it's an exciting time for PAs, and we're very, very busy, and we're going to talk a little bit about how busy we are and how exciting it's been. So let's talk about our busy year. So I want to talk about the healthcare environment for just a second. And for those that have seen me give this speech, we've really reached a tipping point in healthcare in an unprecedented moment. And I know we're tired of that word, but it truly is unprecedented. And really, thanks to this perfect storm of healthcare crises, which include workforce shortages, a mental health crisis, our aging population, and a rise in chronic disease like obesity and diabetes, we're really in a tight spot here. So let me give you a little bit about this perfect storm. So data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that over 2% of the healthcare workforce quits every single month. 2%. And on top of that, according to HRSA, we have more than 98 million Americans in this country that lack access to primary care. 98 million. Just an unacceptable number. 157 million lack access to mental health care. And the population of people age 65 and older is projected to reach around 81 million by 2040. And according to the CDC, over 42% of adults over the age of 20 are obese, and nearly half of the U.S. population is diabetic or pre-diabetic. So these numbers show that we're really facing, and our country is facing, a tremendous challenge, and patient demand is outpacing provider supply. But there's one thing we know, is that there's PAs. Right? The PA profession is continuing to grow, and in fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects a 28% increase from now until 2031, and the PA profession growth is 5 times higher than all other average professions. For the 5th year in a row, the PA profession was named U.S. News top job, a top healthcare job, as well as a top healthcare, top STEM job. And our healthcare system, and more importantly, our patients need PAs. And we need you. Because we need everybody to be a brand ambassador. And I'm sure you've seen all we've done with the PA brand, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit. But every interaction you have with a patient, it doesn't matter, derm, CV, primary care, any interaction that you have, you are representing the PA brand. And one key component of the PA brand is our title, Physician Associate. So here's where we are right now, Physician Associate. We've officially changed our name, and our professional title has changed. The title of the organization is American Academy of Physician Associates. But as PAs in clinical practice, until your state law changes, when you're interacting with patients, you must still say PA or physician assistant, okay? So we have to go state by state to change the state law. However, you can change the names of your societies, the names of your PA programs, and everything else that you have branded as PA can be changed to physician associate. You can legally do this. It's actually relatively simple. And so most of your organizations, I ask you to reach out to your state organization if they haven't already done so. I know the Society of Derm PAs is already on their journey with this. We've had a couple of people change. And this is something that will occur over time. And we just have to be very careful when we're talking to our patients so that we don't misrepresent ourselves. And we're going to work on changing this probably over the next 5 to 10 years it's going to take for us to change completely to associate. It's very complex, and it's challenging, and it's going to take us longer. But title is just one part of brand. It's not all of brand. It's a very, very small part. And, you know, our new brand, which we unveiled at the conference in 2022, is really about elevating the role and the relevancy of the PA profession. And we want to ensure that our patients, our colleagues in healthcare, our policymakers, our leaders, the media, all understand the unique value of the PA profession. So since 2022, AAPA's media relations team has successfully pitched and placed over 70 interviews and stories in mainstream local and national media outlets, as well as LinkedIn and health trade media, all demonstrating how PAs go beyond. And I'm excited to report that since the launch of our brand in May, we've reached over 76 million impressions for PAs Go Beyond. PAsGoBeyond.com is your resource to learn about the brand and has a lot of useful assets like social media posts, flyers in both English and Spanish, and a toolkit specifically for our constituent organizations. This brand is going to help each of us tell that PA story, which is really a critical part of raising awareness of the PAs Go Beyond campaign. So let's talk about something exciting. I don't know about you, and I've been a PA a long time, but this was probably one of the most exciting PA weeks I believe we've ever had, and one of the most that we've ever been so present in mainstream media. And what we used PA Week for was really an opportunity to optimize and promote PAs Go Beyond. We focused on raising the relevancy of the PA profession more broadly among the general public, the media, legislators, and the broader healthcare community. So we asked PAs and PA students to help us go beyond, and they delivered. There's always a lot of excitement around PA Week on social media, and this year was no difference. We leveraged 18 of our social media influencers and their network to amplify our message. Throughout the week, we saw engagement from legislators, reporters, healthcare providers, and other large healthcare systems. And in addition to that, the compliment on social media, we earned a lot of new media opportunities for PA Week. We pitched stories about PAs who exemplified going beyond in national and local news outlets to highlight PA value and educate the public. And through our earned media efforts, we reached over 5 million viewers who got the message loud and clear. To reach patients and general public and other stakeholders, we launched a comprehensive and strategic paid advertising campaign. And we ran ads across a variety of outlets and mediums, including CNN, Fox, MSNBC, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Pandora, Spotify, Politico, Google Ads, and Boston Transit. This PA Week was like nothing we had ever seen before, and I hope you were as excited as I was. And you can see just a few of the snippets that we did there. About the PA profession. And though PA Week is behind us, this was just the beginning of where we're going with the PA's Go Beyond campaign. So let me shift gears for just a second, and I want to talk about federal advocacy. So one of the most important parts of the AAPA, and hopefully for all of you in this audience, is making sure that PAs are able to practice to the top of their education and training so that they can continue to provide high-quality access care to patients. So we have been working tremendously hard on the state and the federal level. So I'm going to talk about the federal level, and I don't want to go too much into this because I really want to use a lot of time here at the end to answer your questions and really do more town hall style. But just as a snippet, the RAISE Act was signed into law earlier this year, and this was a partnership between the AAPA and the Veteran Affairs PAs Association, as well as several nursing organizations, to ensure that PAs employed by the VA in high salary areas are eligible for competitive pay above the caps. On June 7th, the House of Representatives passed an Improving Access to Workers' Compensation for Injured Federal Workers Act by a huge margin, 325-83 bipartisan vote. And what this will do is ensure that PAs will be able to take care of those federal workers when they are affected on the job. And it's, you know, workers' comp is one of those tricky situations, and I don't know how much dermatology has to experience with this, but it is one of those areas where you can take care of everything in primary care, but if you get injured on the job, you have to go somewhere else. And so we really have been working to change some of the workers' comp law at the federal level. The recent Leadership and Advocacy Summit, we had almost 170 separate meetings with legislators and staff with PAs on Capitol Hill. And most recently, you'll see at the bottom there, and I just met with the SDPA Board of Directors, talked about my meeting at the White House, which was a huge deal for us as being one of the 12 organizations, medical organizations in the room who are there to talk about partnering with the Surgeon General, as well as the COVID-19 Task Force, to work on all different types of healthcare legislation, but particularly in this arena. And I will tell you, and I can answer more questions when we do the Q&A, but it really was life-changing for me. I've worked in advocacy a long time, and one of our famous staff members at AAPA, who's retired now, she used to tell me, you know, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. And I'll tell you, PAs are at the table. And it was a long time coming, yes. It was a long time coming, and I'm very proud of where we are. We have a long way to go, and we can't stop now. And so this is where we're gonna need all your help. So let's talk about advocating for PAs at the state level. So I'm proud to report that there were 10 OTP-related wins across the country, making sure that PAs have the ability to practice at the top of their education, and optimal team practice is remaining a top priority. This change is crucial for the advancement of the PA profession and for patients, okay? At the end of the day, every single thing that we do is about the patients, and every move that we make is about the patients. And so in order to meet, you remember those 98 million people in this country without access to care? Well, I have 160,000 PAs who are ready and able to take care of them, and we need to give them the ability to do so. OTP is crucial for the future of the profession. And we need to help PAs have more autonomy and flexibility at the practice level. We will always collaborate with our physician partners. We will always collaborate with nurses and other members of the healthcare team. It's fundamentally who we are. But it doesn't mean they get to dictate what and how we practice every single day. We know how we practice. We are one of the most rigorously educated medical professions out there who practice medicine. And with OTP and modernizing legislation that hasn't been changed since the 1960s, hopefully we can get there. But I want to give you an example. So many of you probably know Susanna Storing from Colorado. And her story, you know, she had worked in a rural area of Colorado where healthcare provider turnover is high. And she had been practicing for over 20 years when her physician that she worked with retired. So for nearly two decades, she provided preventative HIV treatment and long-acting reversible contraceptives. However, the current scope of her new physician that she worked with did not include preventative HIV treatment, hepatitis treatment, or birth control, which meant she can no longer, after 20 years of practice, provide those services to her patients. So she is now required to send patients she's been treating for other years to other locations, up to over an hour away, sometimes with a three-month wait, all because of outdated law in Colorado. And this is just one example of the one state with inefficiencies requiring a specific relationship between a PA and a physician. It doesn't mean that we don't value our collaboration and how we work with physicians, but we need to allow PAs to provide the care that they have the skills and the experience to provide. We will have to be strategic. We will have to collaborate with all of our constituent organizations very thoughtfully and think long term. I was telling the board last night, it's not the strongest who survive, it's those who can suffer the longest. And so it's a long run with advocacy, and step by step and piece by piece, we can get there. I remember 20 years ago when we were arguing about whether we should still have the fundamental degree of the profession be a certificate. And everybody that was thinking it'd be a bachelor's degree was a terrible human being. And so you can see how far we've come. And in March, I'm participating in a doctoral summit with PAEA, NCCPA, and others. So patients have changed, medicine has changed, healthcare has changed, and we need to change along with it because we have the skill set and the expertise to help provide patients in this country the care that they deserve. So as we modernize laws, we need your help. And we need there's always an opportunity for you to be involved, whether it's with SDPA, whether it's locally in your community. Those grassroots efforts and you sharing your story are what's going to get us there. So let's talk about some other things before we move on to the Q&A session. We're running out of time here. Let's talk about DE&I, and I want to mention this for how important this is to the Academy, and we've really worked on how we can do this better. We have a lot of challenges in this space, from diversity, equity, and inclusion, from education to practice, and in medicine in general, right? And we have not done enough. And we recently met at the NCCPA Represent Summit. Leaders from all the organizations, including myself, as well as the CEOs, signed a cross-organizational pledge to take an active stance to address racial and ethnic inequalities in our profession. In addition to this, we are working on addressing healthcare disparities and health equity for all. So, as part of the Leadership and Advocacy Summit, the four organizations' leaders met to talk about how we can do it better and to stop talking about it and start taking action. And so we are working and have met repeatedly and are going to be going to have a cross-organizational strategic plan as it comes to diversity, equity, and inclusion on how we can do it better. We do a lot in the DE&I space. If you don't know, we have a whole resource center on our website. We participate in the All of Us research program. We have peer representation on the Steering Committee for National Minority Health Alliance. Also been invited to the National Initiative for Health Equity. We have Diversity Award, as well as quarterly webinars with our partner, Vituity, to talk about DE&I partnerships and some of the issues that we face, and actively educate minority, help to educate minority and underrepresented students through Project Access. So there's always something new going on. This is something that we will continue to focus on as an organization, in addition to our title change, our OTP, as well as our long-term strategy and research that we plan to work on over the next 5 to 10 years at the AAPA. So with that, I'd like to open it up for discussion in our Q&A session. I'm going to ask my colleagues to come back up here. I believe there's microphones all around, and I'm going to turn it over to you guys for any questions from the group of us up here.
Don't everybody jump up at once. I mean, all right, so we want to take some questions. Anything that you have for myself, Jennifer, let us know. Spit them out. We know you have questions. Come on.
I'm going to open it up. Hi, Lauren. Jen, it's nice to see you speak. I've been following you since your efforts in the state of Illinois. I think you're a rock star. You're a warrior.
She is.
I have a question about OTP. And I guess all of it, OTP, name change, law modernization. At the state level, I can tell you in the state of Arizona, I was on a committee with the Arizona State Association of PAs, the legislative committee. Our first maneuver was to simply change the language in the law from supervisory to collaborative. And When we worked with our lobbyists, their first maneuver was, we need physician support. We need physicians to get behind it. So we made that effort. And any guesses how many docs came forward to support it?
Zero.
Zero. Just to change the word supervisory to collaborative. So I would love to hear your thoughts, because you did so much in the state of Illinois. How do we start with that? Where do you find that? And then I would ask, our state chapter of the SDPA, we're small, and there's not a ton of manpower. Certainly at the legislative level, it's pretty much me. What resources do we have as a state from the APA? What can we do to what resources can we use from the APA? And then lastly is individual PAs. What can I tell my peers in the state of Arizona to do to get behind this movement? I know that's a lot of stuff, but I know it's all stuff you'd probably like to talk about.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. These are all good questions. We just came from breakfast, and I met with the SDPA board. Where are you guys? Wave your hands over here. Amazing group of people. So thank you for asking that. So we'll do the easy questions first. When it comes to state constituent organizations, you can go to our website, and everything you want, from OTP to name change to toolkits to briefs on any topic in medicine that you can use from an advocacy perspective, is on our website. And if you don't see something that you need, you can email us, email me personally or anyone, and I will have a member of our advocacy team reach out to you. There are directors assigned to each one of the states and who are very, very knowledgeable and can help through any partnership. And I think what I stressed with Lauren here and with the board is really we're here to be your partners. We don't know. You guys are our eyes and ears in every single state. I don't know what's happening. However, we as the national organization have the resources to partner with you and to help you and to come up with a strategy. You know, one of the strategies I think PAs have used in the past is putting all their efforts into how do we convince physicians to support us, right? So we put all of our efforts doubling down into how do we convince physicians to support us. And guess what? That's not really working. Because why should they support us? That's great. We have a lot of good relationships with them. I work in a very pro physician PA institution. I have a lot of physicians who support us. But there's a lot of fear out there from physicians about submitting written work and supporting PAs. So I think what we've really done is talk about why is this good for patients? Every single thing that you do at the state chapter level isn't about we need this because PAs deserve this, or the NPs have it and we don't, or somebody else does it. It's because 98 million Americans are lacking access to primary care. The research studies when we did name change show and demonstrate from patients and physicians that the assistant title and the supervising physician make no sense in terms of their name. That collaborating was much more how PAs interacted, that we collaborate, and that the title itself wasn't representative of all we did. So I would utilize all of those resources and research. And I would say when it comes to a physician, all it takes is one. All it takes is one that will partner with you in the legislation, and I always go after my collaborating physician as first person. So that's what we did in Illinois. Every single PA in Illinois, I didn't say go find physicians. I said every single one of your collaborating physicians needs to sign this letter that they support this. Otherwise, you shouldn't be working for them. And magically, hundreds of letters appeared in our office that we presented to the legislature that said physicians are in support of moving from supervision to collaboration. I don't know what it is in Arizona, but it was also another argument that we had in Illinois was that the NPs were collaborating, but the PAs were supervising. This just confused everybody. And so for efficiency in the healthcare system and efficiency for patients and hospital systems, everybody wanted the same collaborating physician language, and so that's what resonated. But it is all you're doing and chipping away piece by piece by piece is the right thing. You got to use those community grassroots and your stories about why this is important to get the PAs to rally behind you and say how great you are. We were talking about, we are a very humble profession. We don't like to say how great we are. Every single one of you in this room is a badass and are experts in their field. But we don't like to say that. You're an expert. You should not be afraid. I walked into that White House and they said, Dr. Jennifer Orozco, physician associate. That's the change we're seeing. And if we can do that and I can sit across the AMA and they can call me physician associate across the table, I think we're winning. So we can do that at the practice level, and I'm here to empower you guys to do that. And anything we can do to partner and get resources on, that's, you feel free to reach out to us, and I'll help you in any way that we can. That's what we're here for.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So you kind of segued into what I was going to ask anyways, but I've been practicing for 12 years in dermatology for 4.5 prior in ED. I still work in ED, and I've noticed working both in like private practice and then in more of academic settings, kind of a change in residents and kind of their view towards PAs. So I was wondering what the AAPA is doing, if they're going into residency programs, teaching a little bit more about the PA profession, and also what the SDPA is doing to kind of change that culture with the AAD to get dermatologists a little bit more realizing we're here and we're not going away, and there's a lot of us and we can help. So I was just curious what's being done or what things we can also do.
Sure, so I'm gonna go first.
Sure. So as far as our relationship with the AAD, our board or our executive board meets with the AAD at their meeting once a year, and we discuss issues, and Renata Block and myself sat with them in March at their meeting and discussed some of the issues. And, you know, we were told that some of the younger physicians, you know, for years we thought it was the older physicians that had an issue with PAs, that it was them that didn't want us to really move forward. But we're starting to hear that a lot of the residents and the younger physicians that are coming out feel that we're a threat, that we're taking their jobs. And so they're not happy with that. And you know, you probably all see things on social media. We did discuss that with them. But one of the things that I took away from Jennifer in the last, 12 hours that I've been chatting with her, is that we can talk about these things and we can work towards our goals, but we don't have to prove ourselves. That was something that she just mentioned. Like, we have already proven ourselves. We've proven who we are and what we do, and we don't have to prove to them anything. So we set our goals and we continue to move forward with what we have planned, what we want to achieve. You know, we're going to continue to work on legislative at the state level, at the national level. Those are the things that we need to focus on, and it doesn't mean that we don't get upset every time there is something put on social media. It doesn't mean that we don't want to rebut anything, you know, articles that are put out. You know, we do when we feel that we need to, but I think you just eloquently put it, we don't have to prove ourselves to anyone. We're still going to continue to meet with them. We've been working on that relationship for decades. We feel like we're making some progress in some areas, and we're going to continue to push that. So that's what we're doing. But we realize that, you know, this is not something that we're going to be able to do overnight. This is something, just like Jennifer said, we're going to have to chip away at. And at the end of the day, we may not change the views and opinions of any of the physicians or the younger ones. Because at the end of the day, just like she said, we are badasses and the residents know it. And you know, that is what it is. But we're going to continue to push forward with what our goals are. So
I think absolutely. And I think the residents question is a good one. I think we're seeing that in pockets, and we're seeing that in certain specialties. But the reality is, medical school education, it's actually a requirement for interprofessional education. And the other reality is that majority of residents now all have some sort of interaction with a PA in some way, shape, or form as part of just practice in their education. You know, when I was young, we were kind of hit or miss. I was the first vascular surgery PA the county had ever seen. But that's not how it is anymore. And so most of the residents that are out there are very pro-PA. And I was telling them the story, you know, I'm part of the operations leadership team and partner with recruitment for all the faculty contracts for the physicians and the APPs. And the first thing all the physicians ask for is how many PAs are going to be in my contract. And so I always laugh when people say, well, wait a minute, you're not really pro PA, but then you just asked me for how many people I'm going to get. And you don't want to ever talk to them. You want to be in the operating room and they run the clinic. So, you know, you can't have it both ways. And what we've really tried to do is focus more strategically on what are we doing and what's good for patients. I'm not here to you know, spend my energy and efforts on trying to convince residents or physicians or the AMA to work with us, because that's not what we're here for. We're here to say we're 160,000 strong and growing, and we have the expert, we have the skill set and expertise to take care of people. 98 million Americans in this country should not have access to care. It's just, how is that acceptable in 2022? And I think that resonates with folks. And dermatology is a very big part of that. It's embedded in all of primary care. And so this is something that patients need, and patients want to be seen, and they want to know that they have a competent and skilled provider to do so. And we've proven that and have research to back that up. So that's a great question. I think we, and I'll speak to the national level, we are working with many of the medical organizations as a conversation. I talk to them regularly. I mean, I just did a webinar with the AAMC, or there's so many acronyms, just last week, talking about PAs and our why it's important that we're involved in all of our response, as well as our nursing homes and some of our older adults. And so these are all the good things we just got to keep doing. And I think the more we stay positive and focused and not reactive, you can't respond to everything. I was saying the hate mail that I get of how come you're not responding to this every day. If I responded to everything that came at us, we wouldn't be doing anything but responding to people. And so we're not going to stoop to that level. We're going to keep our patient focus and talk about what great clinicians we are and how we're being underutilized.
Continue to educate ourselves, you know, coming to meetings like this and improving your knowledge, improving your skills. You know, we've got one of our volunteers that was lead author and just published. Those are the type of things where we're, in a way, we're proving ourselves. We don't have to, but we're proving ourselves that we're at the same level, that we can do those same things. We have the knowledge and the skill set. So continue to improve yourselves, and I think that's one way, that's something to focus on.
Yeah. There's a question up here from Research. Do you want to take that one?
Yeah, I'll read the question. What is a good response when asked why PAs are required to do a recertification examination when other medical professionals do not? So I do have an answer for that. Other medical professionals are doing recertification process. And like I said, 24 of the American Board of Medical Specialties actually all have some sort of a longitudinal assessment component to remain board certified. And those are our physician peers. The other thing is, and I'm just going to put on my old, I was the president of the Minnesota PAs, and I did a lot of advocacy. We have a lot of favorable legislation in Minnesota, actually, through years of going through OTP. And one thing I know when I was a PA advocating for this profession, what I talked about is, number one, the guiding principle of our profession is the flexibility of, you know, we are trained as generalists, we can go into specialty, we can be dual employed. Imagine the number of PAs are dual employed in other specialties. And one of those, when you're talking to legislators and other healthcare employers, et cetera, one of the things that I'd always bring forth is not just our rigorous training, you know, the students that we bring in, but also our recertification process, our CME, our testing. So that was one thing I'd constantly bring forward when talking about OTP. And so I just wanted to remind people that that's one thing that we need to always highlight is how well we're trained, how we keep up our knowledge, how unique that we are, that we can go in and out of different specialties. That is so unique, we can never give that up. And so, yes, we're not the only ones, but as you can see from the new process, it's going to be a lot less painful.
Great.
I'd just like to ask a question. How many in here have practiced in a specialty or field outside of dermatology? Look at that.
That's so. What I'm talking about.
Yeah. It's a lot.
We have a question down here.
I'm kind of hiding over here in the corner. I'm sorry by the podium.
Oh, there you go.
I think it's important. I've been a dermatology PA for 19 years, and I'm proud to be a PA, and I think most of us in this room probably chose PA school over going to medical school, so it wasn't like, I didn't get in, let me go for a lesser route. But I think it's important as we are advancing our degrees that when we're in clinic, if I have a doctorate, I'm still Jennifer in clinic. I think it's very confusing to the patient as we're seeing mid-level providers get doctorates, which is fabulous, but then advertise themselves as Dr. Jones or Dr. whoever. And the patients, for transparency, and that's who we're here to take care of. We want it to be as clear to them who's taking care of them and that I'm proud of the fact that I am a PA and I don't need to, quote, misrepresent myself as an MD.
Yeah. No, and you bring up a good point. So that's actually policy from the HOD and the AAPA, and that being very clear with patients that you are a PA and what setting that you use it in. And this again is going to be a journey. We haven't, you know, there are a lot of PhD as well as our DMSC folks and that are starting to come out and what we're doing. But it's something that is important and something we need to continue to work through and talk about and be very clear with what we're doing. So thank you for that.
And that's one thing that the AAD did mention that, you know, we discussed, you know, just as you said so eloquently, we're PAs. We're not trying to present ourselves as physicians. We chose this profession. It didn't, you know. So we have heard, you know, they don't want us to try to misrepresent ourselves as physicians. And definitely we've heard the doctorate issue as well. But I think it's amazing for all of those who have gone and gotten their doctorate. So just because I like to ask questions and interact. So how many in here have your doctorate? Raise your hand. Okay. Fair number.
Yeah. I think the other thing is to remember, again, a lot of what we do sometimes has been, the fear has been ingrained in us over the years, and it's something we have to get rid of as PAs. You know, chiropractors are called doctors, dentists are called doctors, physical therapists are called doctors, OTs, audiologists, that's right, pharmacists. So, you know, we as a profession, we're going to get there. We have to respect one another and the journey that we're on. But I want everybody to feel empowered. You can call me if you don't. I have heard some terrible things that have happened to PAs and PA students out there. And I always say to them, you can just call me. I will call somebody and we will talk to them. But we have to support one another in this and where we want to go. Because at the end of the day, it's only the patients who suffer when we don't do what we're trained to do. So question over here.
Yes, I have a question for the NCCPA back to the recertification. I know that, and this is something maybe you could help us understand, in order to remain board certified, a lot of specialties are requiring their physicians to do these types of exam to maintain that certification. However, the PA profession as itself still remains the only profession that if you do not recertify tomorrow, you do not have a job. Whereas those physicians can still practice, they just can't call themselves a fellow anymore of that parent organization. So how do we justify that as physician assistants that we create a stress upon the entire profession when we have our lives going? I have had close colleagues who have had major accidents. One had a brain tumor. Some had gone through divorces, and they are having to do these certifications to maintain their ability to generate an income and keep a roof over their head. How do we justify that for this profession when no other profession truly has to do that in order to show up tomorrow?
Well, let me preface it by saying if there, any time in the recertification process, if there is a emergency or you can't meet a deadline, that we actually work with PAs all the time to make sure that there's no disruption in their certification. And so you just have to reach out to us and contact us. You know, I'm just going to go back to my original answer that we really use this recertification process, staying current, being able to go in and out of different specialties as being rigorously trained in our profession. And I'm going to stand by that. It's actually really worked even in Minnesota to advance OTP. And I think it, right now, the Pannery LA, the recertification process being such, it'll be so less painful for PAs that I think it will be much better going forward. And like I said in my presentation, we're really listening to feedback from PAs, and I actually do bring back feedback that I get from when I'm out in the public. And so, yes, I will, you know, let them know your sentiment as well, but I think at this point we're still going to continue on this recertification to stay competitive in the workforce.
Thank you.
I can't answer, I'm not going to answer that question in particular, but I just want to make one comment because, you know, it's something that we went through as I did in the state, and this is really a FSMB fundamental, which is uncoupling licensure and board certification. And
so that would be wonderful.
And so I think, depending on your state, some states have this, Illinois being one of them, that, you know, a lot of the times there's an initial board certification that you must have to get your licensure, but renewals, depending, you don't necessarily have to have that board certification for reasons that you talked about. And I'm not saying what you're saying is not true, and that I believe there's a lot of good philosophy and discussion around this, and it's a good discussion we have to continue to have in the profession. But I do think it's very important, as someone who lives in this space, to not tie licensure and board certification together. And the reason is, when you lose your license due to a lapsed board certification, you have to report that forever. That follows you around the rest of your career, and you could not get hired, which is part of the importance of it. It doesn't mean that taking a board isn't important or maintaining your CME, all of those things are important, but when you tie those two together, it becomes a problem. So I ask everybody, I don't know how many people know, do you know what it says in your state? And if not, go back and look. If something happened to you, right, I have cancer or you had to take a hiatus for whatever reason, it happened to be during board certification, I've had to fire 3 people in my organization in the past for failure to pass the board certification because it's a requirement. So these are the types of things that just, and they had been practicing 25 years. And so these are the struggles that we face, and I think it's a conversation we need to continue to have, and we should have in the profession, but I think we have to, truly respect each side and really come to consensus. And I know we at NCCPA and AAPA and all the other orgs, we are really committed to having much more open discussion and dialogue about these really tough subjects that we have to do as a profession. And they're tough conversations to have, right? What the title change, OTP, you know, this, DE&I, these are tough conversations, and I know the 4 orgs are committed to working through them, but we'll need all of your support to help guide those conversations. But good points for bringing that
Thank
up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So it looks like we have
there's another person. Oh. Hey, Lauren. Hi, ladies.
Hi.
Gina over here. I think that's a great segue into state policies, and I think a lot of us forget the change happens in our states, and the change happens with our lobbyists, which takes our PAC money. And this was an eye-opening experience for me when I attended the AAPA leadership a couple years ago and saw the significant difference between the PAC money that PAs have versus the PAC money that our physicians have and that our nurse practitioners have. So I think it would be great, Jennifer, if maybe you can touch on the PAC, what the PAC is, remind each and every one of us in this room how important it is to contribute and donate to our PAC and to our PAC for our individual state, because that is how we are going to make change happen.
Thank you. And go ahead.
This is Gina Mangan. She's past president from 2018, and she's our AAPA liaison. So.
Thank you for that. And I'm smiling.
Because we were just talking about that.
Because we were just talking about the PAC. And I was asking if SDPA had a PAC and who has a PAC. So not every state has a PAC. AAPA has a PAC. So a PAC is your advocacy tool. And so we have a large PAC. I shouldn't say large. It could be better. But we've done a lot of good things over the last couple of years. You have to donate to the PAC. It's not tax deductible. But this is the dollars that we use in the House and in the Senate at the federal level, and then in your state organizations, it's the money that they use when talking to legislators. And whether you agree with it or don't agree with it, they're the ones making laws for you and deciding how you can practice and what you're doing. And so as a PA profession, we don't care whether you're Democrat or Republican or independent. We don't care about all of that. What we care about is the people who are going to advance legislation that's best for PAs, that's best for their patients, and that is looking forward to the future of modernizing healthcare. So the statistic, and I'm ashamed to say I don't know what the number is off the top of my head, but I was sharing with everybody, the largest donor to United States at the federal level, both all of Congress, in the top three, you want to know who number two is? The AMA. Number one is the NRA. Okay? So the amount of dollars that the AMA has is huge. It's not anything we can compete with. However, as a profession, we don't do a lot of donations to our PAC, but that's where we have to get in that door, right? Remember I said, you're not at the table, you're on the menu. Well, guess what? If we don't use the dollars in our PAC, I can't meet with people. I can't go to fundraising events. I can't send board members. Whatever it is, we need to support the PAC. So if you don't want to go meet with legislators or write an article or whatever you don't want to do, $5, $10, $100, $1,000, it doesn't matter. Any donation to the PAC helps us as a profession. This is the largest PAC donations that we've had for the PA profession, probably because we're growing in number, right? So we're getting there, but we're still at the bottom when it comes to the physicians and the NPs. So we have a long way to go. I'm happy to get some of those numbers. Maybe you can share them later in your membership meeting. And it really is something that we can do better and really helps us as we start to advance the profession. Okay. I think we have a question up here.
So is there a question? No? Okay. So someone has a question about explaining more about what the DERM CAQ is. So I'll let you take that, Sheila, just because you can talk about the other CAQs in general and what those are.
Perfect. So actually, specialty societies of PAs usually bring us, hey, can you create a CAQ, which stands for Certificate of Added Qualification. And again, this is a voluntary credential on top of your generalist certification. This isn't required. You have to be certified and hold a license to actually be eligible to get a CAQ. So it's not something that can go before. You can't get a CAQ first and then become certified or licensed. So it's got to be, and again, it's voluntary. A couple things with the DERM CAQ, again, that was brought to us from the DERM PAs. We're interested in having one. There's a couple list of items that you would have to accomplish. The application's open now, and you would start working on it in 2023. There is a years of experience requirement, which is about 4,000 hours to full-time years of work in dermatology. 75 credit of CME, Category 1 CME. This is not in addition to your regular CME, but you can use it instead, really focusing on your CME. And I may have had some people in here that were on the group that actually helped develop this with the NCCPA. So for example, for dermatology, I think you need 5 credits in
dermoscopy?
Dermoscopy, okay, for some reason my brain didn't do it. So anyway, that would be one of the components. There's an attestation requirement where there's a list of things that either you have knowledge of doing or you have done. Now, for me, in emergency medicine or primary care, there are certain things that I would be able to do every day, like wound care, wound IND, or chest tube placement, et cetera, but not all the time. You know, in some situations that I've been in, either the residents did it or, you know, some of the junior physicians did it. So really the attestation requirement is, do you have knowledge of these list of things that are really relevant to your specialty versus have you done them? Because I think in some, you know, occupational settings, it's not possible to actually perform everything. Finally, there's a small exam, and the CAQ lasts about 100 or 10 years, and you can renew it if you'd like. But a lot of PAs, you know, I hear from both sides that some like the recognition of their skills in the specialty. It has made some PAs more competitive to get employment. I've also heard the opposite, that it has not helped and it did not help them, or you know, they did not get more salary because of it. Really, again, this is, can be state specific or specialty specific, and so I'm not sure if anybody else wants to mention it, but those are the two sides of it.
I think initially our thoughts when we were discussing as an organization was looking at it as just an added qualification. It's elective. You know, we are not for board certification. That's not what this is. So, you know, completely elective. If you choose to do it, we look at it almost as if you decided you wanted to go get your doctorate. So that's how we've always looked at it from an organizational standpoint.
I think I see a question over here.
Sorry, I'll try to be quick because I know it's wrapping up. But
oh, you're fine.
I had a question on, I know there's a lot of PAs who want to get involved in research and article writing, and I feel like that's where we see a lot of our nursing colleagues and our physician colleagues shine, and where we don't really have as much of that out there. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we can get more involved, maybe if we can work with PA programs where maybe before we graduate we each partake in writing an article or getting involved in a research project, just to kind of bring a little bit more, you know, just to kind of show the skill set that we have and what we can offer, similar to our colleagues, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good question. We, and timely, because this is actually part of our strategy moving forward to really increase our research arm. And again, was having this conversation at breakfast today about partnering with some really large research firms nationally for grants and other opportunities so that we can start to have a more robust research arm of the AAPA, as well as partner with all of you. We have had discussions about partnering with our doctorate and PhD programs that PAs are involved in, similarly in a way that physicians and the nurse practitioners often do with their DNP projects and all of these types of things. And so what are the priorities and what are the things that we need to study? One of the challenges that we've seen with PAs is they tend to focus on everything clinical. And so a lot of what we also need in the profession is outside the clinical arm. And so how do we continue to measure workforce development, quality and safety outcomes, patient outcomes directly tied to PAs, revenue, billing, all of these types of things. And so we're really looking to partner with individuals who can do that. Anybody who's interested in research, we do have a large education and research arm, as well as our marketing and communication arm in terms of writing. I am actually looking for writers to partner with a couple of organizations that we have. It's difficult to find PAs who want to write and put articles out once a month or a blog or something like that. But anybody who has interest in that, please email me and I will connect you with the right people. And, you know, for us, anytime the PA voice is out there, it's elevation of the PA profession. And so if people are interested in writing, please let me know. I'm happy to connect you with some folks.
And I can add to that. I know if there's anybody that is interested in writing, I know our JDPA would love to have you. And Cynthia Griffith, I don't know if she's in here.
I'm right here. And I just wanted to say thanks so much for that question. Thanks so much for your support. The JDPA is very interested. We have a lot of partnership with the Doctorate of Medical Science programs. We're very excited about
a lot of our PAs who publish wonderful case reports, and we also are working to publish workforce data. I want to say thank you to the AAPA for giving me a small research grant, which is going to be published in March, talking about derm patient satisfaction. So we're getting out there, and I think with your support of continuing to build, I think we have good avenues into administration, we have good avenues into PA education, but we have a whole generation of PA clinician scientists that would like grant money. And I know that DPAF is also going to fund research of PAs who want to do clinical or workforce research. But I will say the JDPA is open to having any amount of collaboration. If you have an idea but are not a writer, we have writers too. So we would love to continue that partnership because we have a lot of writers, dermatology PAs who are interested and already doing good research and writing great articles. Yeah. So thanks so much for building out that branch and giving us what we need, which is the funding to do it.
Absolutely, and that's really what we're trying to increase now over the years. And I'll just say this, and I don't think I told this story. This is where PAs need to start showcasing all the tremendous work that we're doing. Quick story. So I got invited to a preceptor event in Chicago, and they wanted me to be their keynote, and it was great. And so I went there. It was local, so I went there, and I'm talking to this faculty member who just happens to mention that she was the lead researcher at Johns Hopkins for the COVID-19 vaccine. And I said, I'm sorry, excuse me? And she's a PA. She was a PA. And she said, well, I'm not there anymore because my husband moved, and so we had to move out of state. But I was the lead researcher for 19 months for the COVID-19 vaccine. And I said, you know, this is what's wrong with the PA profession. How is it that I have no idea about this individual? She goes, well, we don't really talk about it. I said, well, why not? And so I know that we have all these people doing tremendous, our clinical scientists, we have all these people doing tremendous stuff in their communities, but we have to be better at sharing it and sharing that story, because that story was so impactful to me. And I was like, well, you should be the keynote speaker. Why am I getting up here? And so we have to do that better, and I hope that we can do that through our writing, both clinically and professionally. I see another question.
Hi. Thank you for all that you're doing up there. My name's Emily. I'm a derm PA in Cape Cod. And I have a question, any of you. We haven't talked about an elephant in the room for our profession, especially I've had friends who have not gone on to become PAs because of the student debt crisis. And I was just wondering, especially when we talk about access to care, I used to work in underserved clinics in primary care. I would just love to hear from any of you what we're doing in that regard.
I don't have much on this topic.
I was going to say, it's probably for me. unless you want to add something, go ahead. You know, this has been a topic at the House for a number of years now. Part of the other challenge with the student debt crisis especially is around PAs not being eligible for certain grants, especially at the federal level. And so I know we've done a lot of work to try and change some of that. It is something that we're continuing to look at across medicine in general, because PAs, physicians, NPs, and others, you know, one of the beauties about NPs a lot of the time is they're a part-time program, and so their organizations will pay for them to go to school, whereas PAs are full-time and have to quit their job and go to PA school, same thing for medical students. And so this is something we've been talking about, and I know that there is a close group working on, and our federal advocacy team has been partnering at the federal level to try to get some of our outdated laws changed, especially so that PAs have the ability to apply for some of these grants that are needed, but we are capped at the amount that we are allowed to have. So we're continuing to work with that. I think it's an important one, again, to continue to have conversation of, because students are drowning. I know many of us did as PAs, and so I think it's something that we need to focus on moving forward, and I know I can commit to continue working with the PAEA on how we're going to address this and try to get some relief for students.
I just wanted to go back just for a second when we were discussing writing and other professional development opportunities. There's going to be some questions in the meeting survey. One of the projects that I would like to see come to fruition, part of what I would love my legacy to be, and something I feel very, very passionate about, is professional development. So there's going to be some questions in your survey because I want to know who's interested in becoming a writer. How many of you are interested in learning how to be a great public speaker or speak for industry? How many of you want to get involved in research? It's limitless. How many are interested in maybe moving on to non-clinical jobs? So if you don't mind, if you'll just make sure that you answer those questions, that helps us get a better idea of who is interested and then how we can kind of focus our programs. Because at the end of the day, I want to be the one in our organization to be the one that provides those opportunities to our DERM PAs. So.
Absolutely. And I'll do one last question because I think we're at the end here. I'm going to take this if that's okay, because I think this is about FSMB.
Yeah.
So the question up here on the screen is around the compact for PAs. And so just to give everybody an update on where we are with the compact, we've been working with FSMB for some time in terms of having a PA compact so that we can have licensure across all of the states. We have finalized most of the language. And have been working closely. One of the board members, Desmond Watt, who maybe you all know was the lead of telemedicine, who was really spearheading that. I've asked him to work with our advocacy team with FSMB, and this has been an ongoing, multi-year process. And it's complicated. So we're finalizing the language, and we wanted to make sure that OTP language was in the compact, because once the compact language is done, we're stuck with it. Whatever it's written, every state has to implement it how it exactly is written, or it doesn't get implemented. In order for the compact to go into effect, 7 states would have to adopt the compact language. So, and that's the same for anybody, physician, NP, it doesn't matter. Everybody at the minimum has to have 7 states. So we're going to work on that you're going to see a lot more about FSMB and the PA compact in the next year here. And us rolling that out and picking key states that we actually think we can get the legislation implemented and in place. So,
and we have how many OTP states right now? Did you say 10?
No, we have 3 full OTP states, and then we have 10 OTP related wins. But we have many more who are joining the fight, and we have a very robust advocacy group for the upcoming spring session. So stay tuned. We'll be up here. I'll be on the side if you have any questions and don't want to come up to the microphone.
Yep.
So happy to chat. Thank you for having us.
All right, we're going to break for lunch, and then we're going to have our product theater. So come back.
Oh, it's lunchtime. Okay. Wonderful. Yeah, Miami.